out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN. The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Crime Prevention 101 with host Susan Bartlestone. We're so happy you've joined us. Over the next hour, you'll learn the tips, tricks, and vital information that'll help you keep yourself confident and safe. Now, here's the host of Crime Prevention 101, Susan Bartlestone.
In November of 2008, 47-year-old Wall Street trader Agnes Bermudez was accused of dousing her 32-year-old carpet cleaner ex-boyfriend, William Salazar, with flammable liquid in a jealous rage, setting him and the apartment building on fire. He died of his wounds a week later and made a deathbed declaration about Bermudez's guilt. Three other tenants in the building also died, and Bermudez, who had been a very attractive woman, suffered severe disfiguring burns to her face and upper body. She claimed self-defense, and I almost served on the jury that eventually acquitted her. Tonight I'm speaking with attorney David Magruder, who won that acquittal, and this was despite overwhelming negative publicity in the media, which just tried the case for him. I'm going to ask him what factors he thinks swayed the jury despite all this media hype about her guilt and why he dismissed me from the jury. I mean, you know, who wouldn't want me serving on their jury? Then we're going to talk about National Police Week, which is coming up on May 15th through 22, to commemorate the brave officers killed in the line of duty. It's an event that's very important to me, and I want you all to know about it. I've also got a personal safety product to tell you about called the Porta Pocket. No more hiding money in your bra or socks, and I like this product a lot. And to start us off in my ongoing quest to try and figure out the criminal justice system, I'm looking into lie detector tests, or polygraphs, as they're known officially. We're going to be talking about lie detector tests and how reliable they are. And this is Susan Bartlestone, and you're listening to Crime Prevention 101, coming to you live, of course, as always, from the Always Hop in New York City, where we're all recovering from royal wedding fever, and the ghosts at Ground Zero can finally stop weeping. Yes, it's been quite a week for us. All right, I want to introduce you to John Fitzgerald, who is a former detective sergeant with the Nassau County Police Department, and now the owner of the Fitzgerald Group, which is a private investigation firm that specializes in polygraph testing, executive protection, and many other private investigation services. And he is a sought-after polygraph expert. He travels all over the world consulting on high-profile cases, and he also appears on TV quite often as an expert. His partner in crime, who's here with him today, Karen Colonello, also an Nassau County Police Department detective, also a polygraph expert, and presently serves as the vice president of the New York State Polygraph Examiners Association. Welcome, John and Karen.
Happy to be here, Susan.
Hello.
Pleasure to have you with me. All right, so let's start at the beginning. John, how about let's start with you. What is a lie detector, and how does it work?
Well, a lie detector is, first off, an instrument, not a machine. People call it a machine, but it's an instrument because it measures certain things. And basically what it does is it measures certain physiological events in the human body that are changing when a person is in either in a stress mode or not. And that stress is initiated basically by a series of questions. We have relevant questions pertaining to the issue at hand. We have comparison or control questions that we use use to use as a comparison to the relevant response, and we have irrelevant questions. They're all based upon a pre-test interview, which is actually the foundation for a good polygraph test.
And you and I were actually talking about that, and this is where the skill of the operator comes in, because the way you design these questions is really critical.
Absolutely, it's critical, and if you don't have a good pre-test interview where both the examiner and the subject have a clear picture of what you're doing that day and why you're there, then the questions don't matter. They have to be based upon factual data and agreed to prior to the test beginning.
And what are some of the processes in the body that it measures?
Well, basically it measures your respiration, your chest breathing, your stomach breathing. There are two pneumographs that are put around the trunk of the person. The electrodes are attached to the fingertips that measure sweat gland activity in the body. And the last parameter measured is the same as when you go to have your blood pressure taken at the doctor. A cardiocuff is put on your upper left arm, and that measures your heart rate and the change in overall blood volume.
Okay. All right, now, Karen, how reliable are these tests, and how heavily do these tests weigh in court in terms of testimony?
Well, what I did was I went on the American Polygraph Association website, and I pulled off some research that was done, because the best way to explain this type of scientific validity would be through research and development. And according to the researchers that have done many testing in the field, 12 studies of validity in the field of examinations, which really were following over 2,000 field examinations, provided an average accuracy of 98%. There are many, many research studies that have gone on in this field, because it's really important in the scientific arena to maintain a level of research in understanding exactly what's going on in polygraph along with other scientific fields.
That's an amazing figure to me. I mean, because I was thinking, you know, I'd be nervous if I was arrested for something, you know, assuming I didn't do it. I mean, I figured I would sweat. I would maybe show signs of nervousness. And yet you're saying 98% reliable, basically.
Well, I think, Susan, what's really interesting is that having done polygraph within a police department and having polygraph people in that particular situation, what's important to understand is that although we are all nervous in the face of being accused of things, nervousness is not the sign of a lie. And when push comes to shove, a person is going to respond to the issues that they're lying to. And even though you are nervous, if you are lying to something, that's quite a different story.
So it's not nervousness that you're looking for. What would indicate a lie? What would it look like? Is it like a graph or something?
Well, when we're looking at the polygraph charts, we're analyzing a person's physiology, and we look at a certain part of the chart in order to make an analysis. And basically, it's a window of scoring. And certain criteria are used based on research and development with regards to how we score, or one would score, a chart. And it's how your physiology changes when you lie versus when you're not and you're being truthful.
And it's all scored in a certain way that will show that.
Yes, and it's based on research and development.
All right, John, let me go back to you for a second. I want to ask you this question. I read an article that you can beat the polygraph test. You can make it say what you want. How would you do that?
Well, what you're talking about is something that there are actually websites about countermeasures and things of that nature that people will do, everything from compressing their stomach muscles to having a tack in their shoe, and all of those types of things that would alter their physiology. But the bottom line is, and as Karen was speaking about, a person arrives at a polygraph situation and they're attached to the instrument. We base our evaluation in a variation from their tracing average. If you were just attached to a polygraph instrument without any questions being put to you, you would still have a pattern of how your physiology is that day. And we ask certain series of questions, which, of course, are all reviewed with the subject prior to them being asked while they're on the test. And those questions are done in a certain pattern, the relevant and the comparison, as I said before. And there's a zone that you look for after a person's asked the question where you're going to look for a reaction. For a person to be successful in manipulating that, they would have to activate whether it would be the tack or compressing their stomach muscles or shifting on the seat that they're, the chair that they're sitting on. All of those things would have to be done precisely at the right moment to alter the test results. And I've been doing polygraph for many, many years, and the only thing I can tell you is that when you're an examiner, you can tell that someone is using countermeasures, and you have to take them to task right away by saying, I don't think you're sincere with wanting to do a valid polygraph test today because I see you're trying to manipulate the results. So that's an easy thing to say in theory, changing their charts, but it's a very tough thing to do in practice.
Well, I was a little skeptical myself, but I think it would really also depend on how astute, you know, that person that's administering that test is. Somebody like you, I don't think we're going to be able to fool, but maybe someone who's newer at it?
Well, I agree with you that if the examiner, the burden is on the examiner to find this out, but I would say to you that if they graduate from an accredited polygraph school, they have gone through drills like that many, many times, and even a new examiner would be able to see blatant countermeasures, and they should call the subject to task so that they're not wasting their time and the person's time.
Excellent. Well, John and Karen, I know you guys are very sought after. You're flying all over the place. Just if people want more information about polygraph testing or they need your services or, you know, anything else that you do, where would they get in touch with you?
Well, they can do it two ways. Number one, they can go to jfitzgroup.com. Or they can call my New York office at area code 212-599-1400.
And you do fly everywhere, so that's not a problem wherever you are. That was the JFITZ, FITZ group.com. And Karen and John, it was just a pleasure to have you on the show. And my wonderful audience, I hope you will check out their website. There's some interesting things on there. I'm very much encouraged by that research figure. Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you very much. We enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
All right. Now, up next, the Agnes Bermudez case had some very compelling elements. An attractive, older, professional woman with a handsome and much younger working-class boyfriend, an alleged jealous rage leading to a fiery death of four people, and a case that was heavily tried by the media. Stay tuned to hear about the verdict and meet the attorney who made it happen.
Step into the doorway to conscious choice, greater health, and well-being. Attain the balance that you've been seeking. Tune in and turn on 1111 Talk Radio. Feed the mind. Embrace positively. Release the tension. Step out of fear. Host Simran Singh will help you broaden your mind and open your heart toward a greater understanding of how to take charge of your life. 1111 Talk Radio is here every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on 7th Wave Network. 1111 Talk Radio, because shift happens.
Violence, theft, drugs, graffiti, it's all part of joining a gang. In times like these, we need to protect our kids and our community from gangs. Gangs often prey on teens with low self-esteem, who perform poorly in school, and who seek a sense of belonging. Protect kids from gangs. Know who they're hanging out with. Encourage them to become involved in school activities. Give kids a positive alternative to gangs. To learn more, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone. We invite you to share your stories, tips, or suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, and Susan will address some of these on future shows. Send your story or idea to solutions at fightsafe.com. That email address again is solutions at fightsafe.com. Now, back to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone.
Hello again, Susan Bartlestone here, and yes, this is Crime Prevention 101, the radio show with an optimistic perspective on a sober subject. Please start tweeting about us. There's a lot of show left, a lot of good stuff coming up. And you know what? You can follow me on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. Come and join the movement. Now, this is a show I've wanted to do for a long time. I got my first real glimpse of how the jury process works last summer when I was screened for jury duty, but dismissed, possibly by my next guest, for the Agnes Bermudez arson murder case, which was a very well-publicized case here in New York City, Queens. After I was dismissed, I went home, I looked up the case on the Internet, and I found that the newspapers and other media had routinely referred to the defendant, Agnes Bermudez, as having murdered her ex-boyfriend in a jealous rage. No doubt about it. But despite all this publicity, her attorney, David Magruder, who is a former prosecutor with a reputation as a fierce trial litigator, and he's appeared on many TV shows as a legal analyst, he's commented on high-profile cases like Michael Jackson case, Lacey Peterson. Well, he won her an acquittal, and I want to hear all about this. So, David, welcome so much to Crime Prevention 101.
Good evening. How are you doing, Susan?
It is just such a pleasure. I've wanted to have you on ever since that case.
This was a
really big, big case here in New York City. You had that deathbed declaration by the boyfriend that Agnes Bermudez was guilty. You had this older woman, professional woman, younger guy thing going on.
Yeah.
The press just loved this case, and they really convicted her. What were your thoughts when you first were asked to take this case?
Well, when I first met Agnes, you have to keep in mind, she was one of the things that I think it was covered because the video of her on fire is what really also set this case off in terms of the press.
That was astonishing.
That there was really, you know, terrible video of her on fire, as well as William was on fire as well. But Agnes was actually knocked down, and if you look at the video of it, it looks like she should have been the person that passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that the case, all the facts added up, was what she was the actual victim of the fire. And when I first met Agnes, she was in Jacoby Burn Center, which is after she was taken to the emergency room at Elmhurst, she had to recover in a long-term burn center with burns probably close to 50% of her body. That's kind of an inexact science. I learned a lot about burns through this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I even had the services of an expert, Dr. Salisbury, who is a former president of the American Burn Center, from American Burn Doctors. And he runs the burn center at Westchester County Hospital. But in any event, when I met Agnes, she was in bad, bad shape. She's physically recovered, come a long way since when I first met her. She was still in the hospital. They had put her, you know, in custody in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I first met her. And as far as we were concerned, she was a victim of this fire. And the interesting thing about it is that when the fire first happened, and William was alive for 2 or 3 days after the fire. Well, William was alive, if you look at the coverage very early on, especially from the New York Times, it was very neutral, as they didn't know who started the fire. But when William passed and Agnes lived, and the three people upstairs passed away, unfortunately, three totally innocent people upstairs
right.
passed away, then all of a sudden the DA is blaming Agnes as because she was the sole living person.
But
and, you know, there's a lot of pressure on
William also make a declaration that she was the one that she set him on fire?
That's what they say is a justification, but that information came out much later. That wasn't that same witness was interviewed several times the day of the incident, and he didn't give that statement. He gave that statement later, and you know, and he also got an immigration deal to help stay in the country. The DA helped work with INS to, after he said he's going to make that statement. That information, which should have been given to me right away, was not given to me until the eve of trial, over a year later. So, you know, this is the thing, and it was interesting. I remember you on the jury. I don't think I was the one that excluded. I just want to say that.
You would say that now, though.
I don't believe so. I don't have a full record of it, so I don't want to say for sure, but I don't believe so. But, you know, Agnes was a victim of domestic violence, and just like people on your show, you know, what came out during the trial was that she was actually punched and slapped by William a couple of times before this happened. And this was her being burned was the culmination of this whole situation. And she was punched, and she should have, you know, at that time, she should have, like some of your listeners should do, she should have called the police and, you know, not been with him after she was physically abused by this individual, because this physical abuse will only escalate, and it escalated, and now you have three innocent people dead upstairs. So that's the tragedy of this case. And of course, William's death is also a tragedy, but in a different sort of way.
Well, that's true. I mean, but it was so interesting the way that this all kind of came about, and he was in the carpet cleaning business, and he had these chemicals around, and that was the chemical that started the fire.
Somehow, both of them ended up on fire.
I don't know who doused who, I guess, but
Susan, Susan, you bring up a great point. Our position, Agnes said from the beginning, and she testified. She, as you know, Susan, you sat on the jury. I'm sure as you follow crime, you know that the defendant does not have to testify. Agnes got up on the stand and testified where she's facing 100 years jail. And I say she's facing 100 years jail because each murder could get you 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she got on the stand to tell her story because she felt so strongly about, you know, what happened. And what she said was, listen, William was a carpet cleaner by his trade. Agnes does not know anything about carpet chemicals. She didn't work in that business. She never helped him. She was a stockbroker.
That's
right. She didn't,
right.
Go, she didn't clean carpets or anything like that. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Susan.
No, that's right. That was one of the interesting aspects of this case.
Yeah, and the prosecutor is the one that pinpointed with their experts, their fire marshals from FDNY, Fire Department, City of New York, they're the ones that said a carpet cleaning agent from underneath the sink was used as the primary accelerant. And if you don't know anything about these, and William, what came out through our investigation was that William had taken courses on these materials, learning which material did what, and so he certified in this and bought these materials on a monthly basis. And if you don't know what does what, one could be a flame retardant. You know, one could mm-hmm. be water-based, one could be oil-based. If you don't know what chemical does what, then I think the likelihood that you would be successful in something like that in a fit of rage is very, very low, let alone the fire. I don't want to cut you off, Susan, but there was also, during the trial, we also had a fire expert that testified, the burn expert, Dr. Salisbury, mm-hmm. that testified that Agnes most likely, he couldn't say 100%, but most likely was facing, her back was to William when the fire first started.
Ah, interesting.
That was his testimony. Now, see, you're not going to read any of this in the New York Post and the Daily News because they had a certain angle in this case.
And I know that our instructions mm-hmm. in the jury box before I was dismissed, that we were not to look up the case, we were mm-hmm. not to watch the TV or read any newspapers or talk to anyone about it. And, of course, the first thing that those of us that were dismissed did before we even got out of the jury room was we went on the Internet and we looked up this case. And were you at all daunted by this negative publicity? I mean, they had convicted her.
I was a bit, you know, and this is they were, the jurors were good. I have to admit that. I listened to some of the comments from the jurors, and it gave me faith in the system, because these were average Queens people who took their duty seriously. When I spoke to one of the jurors, and I think a few of them are quoted in the various newspapers, and they said, listen, there wasn't any evidence to begin with. And if you listen to what they're not, you don't have to listen to me, because I don't think everybody says, oh, defense attorney, blah, blah, blah. But listen to what the jury said. If a juror who was just a regular guy from Queens who said, hey, there was no evidence to begin with, they acquitted Agnes within 3 hours. And that was including lunch, which they usually don't. They're given the option, do they have to deliberate during lunch? If they don't feel like it, they can just eat. So that hour, if you take that hour out, she was acquitted in 2 hours after a 3 or 4 week trial. These jurors weren't crazy. They weren't, and you sat with them. You probably got to talk to them more than I did. These were regular Queens folks, am I right?
I was a little, I think we out of our group, you only picked four. A bunch of them had already been picked, and I never saw those. Mm-hmm. I was curious that of the four you picked, about three of them were college kids that were like 20 years old. And I was thinking back to my own, you know, way of being when I was that young. And would I have been able to convict someone for life when I was 19 or 20 years old? And honestly, I didn't think I would be able to do that. So I don't know that there were four.
There was a couple of college, fresh recently. But these were smart. These were smart people. I mean, and you got to remember. See, they're just not dealing with my client. They're seeing photographs of the people that died in the fire. So if they're just going to go on sympathy,
very gruesome too.
The sympathy would go towards those people that died upstairs. Because really, even if that's where the sympathy lies, you know, I think objectively, because Agnes, even if Agnes is not guilty, she's the one involved in this poisonous relationship that led to the death of these other three people. So I don't think that if you're not going to look at the evidence and just go on, you know, a gut sympathy, I don't think it necessarily lies with Agnes. I think it would go with the three people upstairs that died, had nothing to do. It was a mother, a father, and a son who had nothing to do.
There's another factor, though, David, about Agnes that I thought was interesting, and I was wondering if that may be why you did put her on the stand. She was very severely disfigured.
If you'd seen
the picture of her before, she was a very attractive woman.
She was very scary looking.
And I was wondering if maybe that was one of the, you know, sympathy factors there that swayed the jury. You know, she's really suffered. She suffered enough. Maybe she's, you know, she'll suffer for the rest of her life. Do you think that had anything to do with it?
It could have, but you know, that's not the main reason I put on the stand. The reason I put on the stand is because she wanted to tell this story. Burns are the most painful. When my investigation in this case, and I've never handled a case of regarding arson of this magnitude of burns. And what I found in my thorough investigation, I spoke to both medical examiners, I spoke to several burn experts, is that this is the most painful injury you can ever have, is burn. And so she's been going through this private hell. I hope I can use that word on the radio. For these last couple of years, and she really wanted to tell her story. Agnes is very articulate. She's never been arrested before this incident all her life. She was a Hispanic female from Brooklyn who made it from the mailroom all the way to Wall Street trader. Was able to amass, she wasn't a mogul, but she was able to make it so she could retire at 50 comfortably. She didn't come from money like so many other people. She went to Queens College, and the friends that she's had, the friends that supported her were friends she's known. That's one telltale sign for me for a person's character. She's had the same friend. They all showed up at the trial, people she's known since 1982. that when she started in the mailroom on Wall Street. And so those were the qualities. Everybody I met that knew Agnes loved Agnes. And so that is the reason I put her on. So not so much because she was disfigured, because she's very articulate. She's never been arrested before. And I think the jury could, I think she can get through to the jury as to what really happened.
Well, you obviously did a terrific job for her. You were able to kind of get beyond all of that. And I was even wondering, because I had remembered about that case. It was about 2 years from when it happened, when the trial, or a little year and a bunch. And I was even wondering if you were going to be able to find an untainted jury because of that kind of publicity, which I think is, it's a real shame. And hearing you speak about the details of the case, you know, it could have been a terrible miscarriage of justice. What do we do about this with these newspapers? I mean, that's a rhetorical question. We can't stop
them. Well, you know, it's not in my interest to speak out against these papers because they cover trials. The New York Times doesn't really get involved in local. They actually reported it when it first happened, but they don't get involved at the same level and depth of. I commend the Daily News and the New York Post for paying attention to the local issues and having somebody covering the courts on a regular basis. I just don't like the way that they just have a slant, and it's not a very informed slant a lot of the times.
I agree.
They're going to favor the prosecution because they don't know me necessarily. They want favors from the prosecutor. I saw the two reporters from the News and the Post in the courtroom every day. They did not want. I don't really have a great trust in the media, because I can't control it. In a case with stakes that high, I don't do anything that I can't control to the best of my ability. So I don't go voluntarily speaking to them unless it's in the interest of my client. And I have no assurance of that. But the Post and the News, they did not they got a statement from the ADA every chance they could. I sat 10 feet from them every day. They did not approach me for a statement one time. Not one time. So this is the type of reporting you're getting. I'm standing 10 feet from these two gentlemen, and then not one time did they ask our side. And I didn't approach them because I don't necessarily trust them. But had they approached me, I would have probably spoken to them. They only approached me when the verdict came out. And I got to tell you, the reporter from the News was very disappointed. I could see it in his face. The reporter from the Post, surprisingly, was more objective in his reporting and his attitude than the reporter from the News, which I would have thought the opposite, but that was the situation.
Well, I particularly wanted to bring this point out because we're in New York, but you know this happens everywhere.
Yeah.
Just to wrap things up, what is Agnes doing now, real quick?
Agnes is still living up in Orange County. I haven't spoken to her that recently. She continues to recover from her. I did speak to her. I think by electronically, not that long ago. She has a great family around her. She has her sister who went to Yale and also from the same family, hard, a working class family, but sent their sister to Yale and Fordham Law School. And her sister's a real estate lawyer. She lives up in Orange County. She's just trying to get her life back still, trying to just the physical therapy. And another thing that happened, just as the last aside, she just is, kind of goes to this medical coverage debate. She maxed out on medical coverage, so
I bet.
So everything was coming out of pocket for all her therapies, and she also had to defend herself in this case. So she's had it really rough. She wouldn't have made it without the support of her sister. She has several good friends, and her mother is still in her. Her father passed away, but her mother is very strong and has been there the whole time.
My heart really goes out to her, David, and I wish her the best.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate you having me on your show. Just call me if you need any other commentary.
Yes, well, listen, thank you so much, and maybe you'll come back and do some commentary on some other cases with me.
That'd be fun. I'd like that, Susan.
All right. If you want to find more information about this case, if you have need of a good defense attorney, davidmagruderlaw.com. And I'm going to post links to David's website on my blog, crimeprevention101.com. You can see the videos of the verdict and the video of that we were talking about earlier in the case. It's a fascinating case. Thanks again so much, David.
Susan, you have a great evening.
All right, my pleasure now.
Bye to the listeners.
All right, now, according to the FBI, 160 police officers were killed in the line of duty in 2010. When we come back, how we can honor these fallen heroes.
After more than 17 years' experience teaching safety skills to thousands of women and men, crime prevention and personal safety expert Susan Bartlestone concluded that by thinking and responding quickly, ideally within 20 seconds, potentially violent criminal encounters can be prevented. Using techniques from many different disciplines and illustrated by 60 real-life examples and success stories, Susan shows how it's done in her new book, Think Fast and Prevent a Violent Crime, how to respond to danger in 20 seconds or less. Check out www.crimeprevention101.com for more information.
Violence, theft, drugs, graffiti, it's all part of joining a gang. In times like these, we need to protect our kids and our community from gangs. Gangs often prey on teens with low self-esteem who perform poorly in school and who seek a sense of belonging. Protect kids from gangs. Know who they're hanging out with. Encourage them to become involved in school activities. Give kids a positive alternative to gangs. To learn more, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone. We invite you to share your stories, tips, or suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, and Susan will address some of these on future shows. Send your story or idea to solutions@fightsafe.com. That email address again is solutions@fightsafe.com. Now, back to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone.
This is Crime Prevention 101. This is Susan Bartlestone. Don't forget, we are available on iTunes. You never have to be without us wherever you go. I want to make sure to mention that May 25th is National Missing Children's Day. And for more information on it, you can go to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. That's ncmec.org. And be sure to tune in next week because my show, we're going to feature this topic and I'm going to have a lot of information and resources for you. Now let's meet Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, and we're going to talk about Police Week. And Craig is the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. It's a long name here. I'm going to mess that up, Craig. I'm sure of it. Anyway, this is a nonprofit organization that was established in 1984 to honor the service and the sacrifice of America's law enforcement officers. And for more than 25 years, he's been one of the law enforcement's leading advocates in the media, and his work as a congressional aide and journalist has been widely credited with changing America's attitude towards law enforcement and with saving officers' lives. Craig, welcome to Crime Prevention 101.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but just about three weeks ago, here in New York City, a police officer was killed during a domestic dispute call. He was pushed over a stairwell railing and fell to his death. Just absolutely horrible. And this is, you know, another example of the kind of things, the kind of danger that our police face every day. I read that 160 officers were killed last year. Is that correct?
Well, the numbers have been a little fluid as we've approached the actual engraving of names onto our national memorial. That's when decisions become final. And we're actually adding 152 officers to the memorial walls this year, officers who died last year. So that's the figure that became final this year. There may be a few cases that, as we get more evidence, the investigations are closed. We may end up adding a few more officers' names next year who died in 2010. But right now it looks like 152 deaths last year, 25% more than the 122 officers who died in 2009.
Now, what do you think is responsible for the increase in the deaths? And this is an alarming trend because it's been pretty high the last 10 years.
It certainly has. Let's put it in some perspective, Susan. The 1970s were the deadliest decade in law enforcement history. On average, we lost 228 officers each and every year. More than 100 officers shot and killed each year during the 1970s. We've done a good job of making it safer for our officers since then. Over the last three decades, we've given our officers a lot more training, a lot better training. Certainly have improved the equipment that they're given to help save their lives. Bullet-resistant vests are probably the number one reason why we don't have double the number of officers killed in the line of duty every year. There are actually more than 3,000 police lives that have been documented as having been saved by bullet-resistant vests. So,
really? That's fabulous.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And every officer, for the most part, I mean, there are still some who don't always wear their vest. They should, because vests do save lives. But at least about 75-80% of the officers today, best we can tell, are wearing their vests, and those vests save their lives. Less lethal weaponry, taser stun guns, for example. Studies have shown that when departments use taser stun guns, the number of injuries to the officers and to the criminal suspects drop dramatically. And clearly that means fewer fatalities as well. So a lot of technology changes. Officers are no longer being outgunned as much as they used to be by the criminals, especially during the drug war in the 80s when the criminals were arming themselves with the best possible weaponry, semi-automatic weapons, these high capacity magazines that some criminals continue to use. All of that now, we've got our officers pretty well equipped to deal with them. And
all right, well, that's good, but 152 is still too much. So let's talk about what is National Police Week, and where does the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund come in?
Well, the Memorial Fund started in 1984, actually started by a man named Mario Biaggi, who's a former New York City police officer for 23
years. I know him well. I want to know the name well, yeah.
He's a legendary figure, and I had the good fortune of working for him as his legislative assistant for 10 years right out of college. And he taught me all about law enforcement, and we've done a lot of good work together to help make it safer for our officers, help allow people in the citizenry to better appreciate and understand their service and their sacrifice. And so in 1991, we actually dedicated the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, and it was paid for by private donations. More than 1 million American citizens donated to it, and it's a beautiful 3-acre park in a place called Judiciary Square in downtown Washington, just a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol. And at that memorial, you can walk in. It's a beautifully landscaped park. But on the perimeter, on both the east and the west sides, you have a 3.5-foot marble wall that expands about 300 feet on either side, and on it are the names of some 19,000 federal, state, and local officers who've made the ultimate sacrifice.
Mm.
And so what we have coming up next week is National Police Week. It actually starts May 15th officially and ends on May 21st. We've been commemorating National Police Week in our nation since 1963. President John F. Kennedy actually signed the law, and it's been in effect ever since. In Washington, we started having national ceremonies in 1982. Started out at a small scale. 125 people came that first year to a Peace Officers Memorial Day ceremony, and it's grown tremendously since then. This year, we expect more than 20,000 law enforcement officers, citizen supporters, and thousands of surviving family members of officers killed in the line of duty. They'll all be with us on May 13th at our annual candlelight vigil at the National Memorial. And anyone that wants more information about the week or the candlelight vigil, the officers who've died this past year, whose names are being added, go to our website, and that's
www.lawmemorial.org. www.lawmemorial.org. Okay, good. And what are some of the other events besides the vigil and everything that, because it's a week long series here that
really is. And what we have on May, I'm going up to New Jersey on May 9th, and we're kicking off what we call the Police Unity Tour. This is something that's been going on now since 1997. Police chief in Northern Jersey, Florham Park, New Jersey, by the name of Pat Montori, back in 1997, started this Police Unity Tour. It was eight riders, police officers, who rode their bicycles from New Jersey to Washington to ended their ride at the National Memorial, and his goal was to raise money and awareness for the Memorial Fund, awareness about the number of officers who die every year in this country who more or less do not get the attention, do not get the appreciation, the outpouring of support that they deserve, their families as well. And so Pat's idea was, let's do this bike ride. Let's get the media to pay attention to us. Let them spread the word to the citizens about the service, the sacrifice of law enforcement. And he raised $8,000 that first year.
Fantastic.
That was good, but then it grew to millions of dollars later.
Are these events taking place all over the country, not just in Washington?
Every state and community will have National Police Week ceremonies. Some do it the week before the Washington event so that everybody can come. Some do it the week after. I'm going to be going out to Tucson, Arizona here for a great ceremony they have in Pima County, Arizona, on Friday. And that's when they have their annual memorial service. But, yes, I think just about every community in this country will be doing something to honor our law enforcement professionals, those who've died, those who continue to serve.
Now, is there some way that we can find out what's going on in our local area? Is there a central register or place where we can get the information?
I think the best place to go is your local law enforcement agency, whether it be a police department or a sheriff's office. That's going to be your best guide to what's happening locally. In the old days, you know, 20 years ago or so, maybe nothing was going on. But it's grown so much over the years. We used to, kind of forget about the surviving family members. We didn't build memorials. We didn't have major ceremonies. Now all that's changed. Now we have death benefits for our surviving family members so that they can continue on with their lives. And all of this is happening, and it kind of happened around the same time the memorial was built back in 1984. And a lot's happened since then, and we're going to continue to build a museum to law enforcement. That's what we're working on right now to complement this memorial.
I heard about this police museum.
It's going to be a tremendous must-see destination in Washington. It's going to be built right across the street from our memorial in a place called Judiciary Square, the 400 block of E Street, Northwest Washington. And it's going to be a high-tech interactive experience. It's already under construction. We're going to open it probably around the early part of 2014, about 3 years from now. And it's going to have a forensic science lab so we can see how forensic science is used to solve crimes. Where it's going to have a 911 emergency call center where the visitor becomes the dispatcher. A shoot, don't shoot, use of force judgment simulator. This
is
used by police to train.
Fascinating.
You know all about it. And you know when you do that, people have a much better understanding and appreciation for the split-second life or death decisions that our officers have to make. And that's what we hope this museum will do, is help people understand what law enforcement is all about, the challenges they face, the dangers they face on our behalf, so that hopefully we'll give them more of the support, the respect, the cooperation that they need to do their job safely and effectively. In the end, it's all about making our community safer. And if we don't work with our law enforcement officers in partnership, our communities will not be as safe as they could be otherwise. So public safety is a partnership, but it can't work until citizens have a better understanding of what law enforcement means to this country of ours.
Absolutely. Well, Craig, it's been wonderful to have you on the show. For more information about Police Week and the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, it's NLEOMF.com. Did I get that right?
That'll work. .org or .com, you'll get there.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much for being on the show with me. And I'm going to post, again, this link on my crimeprevention101.com blog. Now, my wonderful audience, stay right where you are. When we come back, a personal safety product that I really like, the Porta Pocket.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
After more than 17 years experience teaching safety skills to thousands of women and men, crime prevention and personal safety expert Susan Bartlestone concluded that by thinking and responding quickly, ideally within 20 seconds, potentially violent criminal encounters can be prevented. Using techniques from many different disciplines and illustrated by 60 real-life examples and success stories, Susan shows how it's done in her new book, Think Fast and Prevent a Violent Crime, how to respond to danger in 20 seconds or less. Check out www.crimeprevention101.com for more information.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone. We invite you to share your stories, tips, or suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, and Susan will address some of these on future shows. Send your story or idea to solutions@fightsafe.com. That email address again is solutions@fightsafe.com. Now, back to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone.
Yes, hello again, everyone. And I can't emphasize enough that announcer just said in the break, if you want me to focus on a topic here, please email me, solutions@fightsafe.com. I've had people that have emailed me on the show, and you might even end up being a guest too. Now, I want to tell you about the Porta Pocket, and I want to introduce you to Kendra Kroll of Undercover Solutions. Hi, Kendra.
Hello, Susan. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Now, you know, Kendra, one of the crime prevention tips that I've always given out, and many of us have, if you're carrying a lot of money, only keep $20 worth of mucker money in your purse or wallet. Hide the rest in your socks, your shoe, your bra. Well, if you've got the Porta Pocket, you don't need to do that. So tell us what that Porta Pocket is.
Sure. Porta Pocket is a carry-in-case system that can be used in multiple places on the body. So if you wanted to keep valuables such as the things we just discussed, whether it be a credit card or cash or keys or a cell phone that has our passwords in it, you're able to wear it under your clothes in areas such as your calf, on your thigh, under a dress, at your waist, on an arm. So it has a lot more functionality than some of the other products that might be in the market that everyone has seen, such as money belts and neck safes, which are really only used in that one spot.
Yeah, when I went to your website, which is Porta, P-O-R-T-A, pocket.com, I saw that there were several different sizes, and that they could actually be very unobtrusive. That you honestly don't have to know that they're there, but you have the option. You can wear
That's right.
It either way.
There's one of the nice things about the system is that you can interchange the pocket sizes based on a given situation that you might have and interchange them. They're also detachable, so if you had a dress on, for example, and you wanted to have your money, maybe you're going out on a town at an evening event, and instead of leaving your purse on the table, you can have it under your skirt, but not have it way up north on your skirt, if you know what I mean, closer to the hem, but detachable, so you can just take it off yourself, and people sometimes think you're a magician. They're thinking, where did that come from? So you could get it off quickly, but it's not going to fall off. It's very meaty as far as the Velcro engagement where the pocket mounts onto the band, which wraps around your leg or your limb. And there's also pockets that are belt loop mounted that slide onto the band, which is the same band that I just discussed. So you have an option of having detachable pockets for lightweight items or pockets that are stationary mounted by sliding onto the band. And that way, if you have a heavy item, such as maybe an insulin pump, that's really important for people with diabetes issues, or an EpiPen for those in the medical requirement, or things like your phone, maybe an iPhone. The latest iPhones are kind of massy. So if you have something like that and you don't feel comfortable with just mounting it on your limb with a Velcro pocket arrangement, you can slide it onto the band and have it more secure in that fashion, too.
And it's not just for women, by the way, right?
That's right. My husband uses his at the gym all the time. He likes his on his ankle when he does leg day, and otherwise he wears it on his waist for his, the MP3 player he just got. They also fit passports, by the way, Susan. I didn't mention that, but my pocket sizes range from small, which is a credit card size, medium, which equates to almost any cell phone you might find in the market. The large is equivalent to the United States passport, and then I have a tall one that would be great for things like sunglasses, or again, as we discussed, people with EpiPens that need for allergies, that kind of thing. They're made for two
sure.
EpiPens.
Now, what's the price range on this?
The price range, depending on the kit, is $8.95 for the tall pocket by itself, up to $24.95 for a kit that includes two pockets and the band. So it's a very inexpensive item that can give you a lot of value because it's a useful thing for every day as well as travel.
Absolutely. All right, so that's portapocket.com.
That's
I'm going to post the link on my crimeprevention101.com blog. Thank you so much, Kendra, for being with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, and you know what? That's a wrap for tonight. But please don't forget, we always love to hear from you. By all means, send me your comments, send me your suggestions, post them on my Facebook page, post them on my blog, email me solutions@fightsafe.com. Don't forget to tell your friends about us, and you know what? You and I will be doing this again next week, same time, same place. It'd be a crime not to listen, so stay tuned and stay safe.
We hope you got some useful information and inspiration this week on Crime Prevention 101. Susan Bartlestone invites you to join us again next Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Voice America. If you want to learn more about Susan's guests, sign up for her newsletter, or find out about upcoming teleseminars and workshops, go to www.crimeprevention101.com today. Have a great week and a safe week.